This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be looking back to what is a largely forgotten chapter in the history of the civil rights struggle here in the United States. And one thing that makes it so interesting is the way that it connects with an issue that is very much up for debate and discussion today, and that is access to health care. We'll be talking this morning some about the Medical Committee for Human Rights. This was a group of doctors and healthcare workers that organized in 1964 to provide support and care for activists who were working to organize black voters in Mississippi. They went on to become involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement and also to fight against discrimination in the medical profession. And they were also among the earliest advocates for universal health here in the United States. Today, though, very few people remember them. Well, our guest for the program, historian John Dittmer, sets out to change that with a book that he has authored that's recently been published. The title of his book is The Good Doctors, The Medical Committee for Human Rights, and the Struggle for Social Justice in Healthcare. Bloomsbury Press is the publisher of the book. Our guest, John Dittmer, is a winner of the Bancroft Prize and several other awards for his book, Local People, The Struggle for Civil Rights in Mississippi. That's a book that looks at civil rights history. It's published by the University of Illinois Press, so you might want to take a look at that. He is a member of the History Department at DePaul University and is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief as they can so we can keep moving along. And I hope you can stay on the topic for us. Other than that, your comments are certainly welcome. Professor Dittmer, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Good to be with you.
Well, I think that you really begin here by talking, in a sense, talking about yourself, saying that, you know, you probably would have been somebody who thought you knew an awful lot about the history of civil rights and the civil rights movement in the United States. And yet you would have said before you really got involved in doing the research that led to this book that while you would have known that the committee had existed, even somebody like you would say, well, I really didn't know all that much about it.
Well, that's true. It was an organization that was, as you said, was founded in 1964. By the late 60s, the time I got to Mississippi, why it had moved on elsewhere. And it wasn't until after I had finished my book on Mississippi that I really began to find out about these people and what fascinating individuals they were. And I also learned some things about the civil rights movement that I hadn't learned earlier, too.
You know, in fact, you began here in the preface with this great story about the fact that there was a conference going on looking at talking about the Freedom Mississippi Freedom Summer. And it was at Tougaloo College where you had taught. And there were all these people here. They were coming there to talk about this. And here was a man. His name is Robert Smith.
Yes.
Interestingly enough, his picture is right on the cover of the book.
Yes.
Who was standing there handing out flyers protesting the fact that at this big conference to talk about the Freedom Summer in Mississippi, there was no acknowledgement of the involvement of the Medical Committee for Human Rights.
Yeah, I was just stunned. I had known Bob Smith, who was the Tougaloo physician, in addition to everything else he had done, for a long time. And to come there and to see him picketing against a conference that I helped organize really took me aback. And then, as I said, 15 years later at the next reunion, why Bob had arranged to have a session on the medical committee. And there I met interesting people like Tom Levin and Alvin Poussaint and others. And at that point, I decided that theirs was a story that needed to be told.
Yeah. And I'm sure that we'll go on and we can talk about some of the people. But it's very striking that some of the individuals who were involved in the committee are names that you would recognize today. Alvin Poussaint, for example, was one who's very well known for writing about children and child development. Mm-hmm. But also some other folks here, like Quentin Young, for example, Sidney Wolfe, people who now, after that point, continue to go on and be really strong advocates for the idea of public health, for the idea that there needed to be a response to people's needs. And of course, Dr. Young, I mean, has for a long, long time been one of the strong advocates for national health. All of these people, and there were a lot of other people like this too, that were involved in this organization and were talking about this issue a long time ago.
Yes, and what has struck me is that although they were professionals starting their careers or well along in their careers in the 1960s, they have continued to be active on a wide variety of fronts, and most specifically now lobbying for a single-payer insurance program. Sidney Wolfe is, of course, the acting president of Public Citizen, and he has used his position with that organization not only to talk about health care generally, but specifically to go after drug manufacturers who were coming up with products for the marketplace that really shouldn't have been there.
Just very quickly, let me again introduce the guest, John Dittmer. He is a member of the History Department of DePaul University, author of a book about the civil rights struggle, which was quite well received, Local People, the Struggle for Civil Rights in Mississippi, won the Bancroft Prize and some others for that book. And he has a newer book that's just out. It takes a look at the history of the Medical Committee for Human Rights. The Good Doctors is the title of the book, and it's published by Bloomsbury Press. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe before we talk a little bit about how it is that the committee came to be, we should just remind people I should ask you to talk a little bit about Freedom Summer and what that was all about.
Yeah, this was a summer in Mississippi where upwards of 1,000 volunteers, most of whom it turned out were Northern college students, came to Mississippi to assist civil rights workers in a variety of things, to work in freedom schools, to man community centers, to persuade people to sign up for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And it was at the beginning of that summer where the three civil rights workers, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, were murdered. And from that point on, that became the major story not only in the nation but all over the world. And these doctors came down because there were very few black doctors in the state. And most white doctors, they assumed, correctly as it turned out, were not interested in assisting civil rights workers in any way, particularly having them in their offices as patients.
Mm-hmm. So it was the one of the groups leading this effort. This was the SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating, often frequently referred to by the initials. This is the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Mm-hmm. They recognized the fact that the people who were coming down here were going to, part of the thing here was you had to have some medical care there ready to try to take care of people. So they sent out a call to New York for doctors saying, look, are there some people there who would be willing to come down here for the summer and to get involved and provide health care for people here?
Yeah, they did. And they came down naively, as it turned out. They thought they were coming down to practice medicine. They were met by the director of health in Mississippi, a man by the name of Archie Gray, a strong segregationist, who told them that they would not get, even though they were licensed to practice elsewhere, they would not get licenses in Mississippi. And he threatened them with malpractice if they did so. So their efforts were restricted from the start. They could, however, administer first aid, and I think the definition of first aid expanded considerably during that summer.
And did they become involved in not only trying to work with and provide whatever services that the activists, the people who had come there for this project, were involved in, but were they also in a more general way got involved in trying to see to the health needs of local people?
Well, this was the big surprise for them and for the organization. When they came down, the civil rights workers were young and they were in pretty good health. But they came across hundreds of thousands of poor black Mississippians who were denied health care on a number of levels. Many of them had never seen a doctor. And in going out into the community and talking with these folks and giving some small amount of aid during the time that they were there, they realized that they had a larger mission, and that was to try to reform the health care system both in Mississippi and in the rest of the country, and at the same time to provide basic primary care as much as they could.
What was the experience like for black, well, maybe I should even ask the question, at this time in the South, how many black physicians were there?
Well, in Mississippi, the state where I was concentrating, there were practically 50, and you know, nearly a million blacks in the state. And so it not only did most blacks not have access to a black doctor, that in many cases, if they went to white doctors, they were subjected to rigid segregation. They had Jim Crow waiting rooms. They very often had to pay money up front. It was not a situation that was conducive to good health.
Well, what kind of challenges would a black doctor in the South face in just trying to practice?
Yeah, that's something that I really deal with in some detail, because it was so striking that black physicians in many southern states, particularly Mississippi, could not join the local medical association, which was all white. Well, this was more than simply a social slight, because you had to be a member of the local medical association in order to get hospital privileges. So at those hospitals that did admit blacks on a Jim Crow basis, and there were not that many of them, a black doctor would have to leave his patient at the hospital door because he was not admitted. So the protest that took place, and that's the cover of my book, showing a group of physicians in Atlantic City protesting at the American Medical Association convention. Now, the AMA was the parent organization for these state societies, and it always took the position that we oppose discrimination, but we are powerless to do anything if the state and local societies decide to discriminate. So this was the first protest. Bob Smith, Dr. Smith, was in it, and the medical committee kept on protesting for the next 5 years. It was not until 1968 that the AMA changed its policy, saying it would expel any group that discriminated. And it was not until last year that the AMA formally apologized to blacks for denying them their rights all of these years. And just last week, why the mostly white Physicians Association in Mississippi issued its own statement of regret at this policy. So it was a long time being corrected, and an even longer time before the groups acknowledged that they had made a big mistake.
Yeah. Well, did in 1968, when the American Medical Association actually changed the policy, and perhaps it in response to the kind of pressure from people who were involved in the committee and others, though at that point, did things really change?
Well, they did change in 68, and mainly because of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Without going into a lot of detail, Title VI of that law stated that you could, if you discriminated against people on the basis of race, you were ineligible for federal funds. Well, it was the following year that Medicaid and Medicare were initiated. So any hospital wanting to have federal funds, and they all needed it, would eventually have to desegregate or lose federal money. So within a relatively short period of time, most of the hospitals were brought into compliance. And as I said, the hospitals were the most integrated institutions in the South in the 60s, and I think they probably still are today.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that in a lot of ways the doctors and I'm sure that you would want to make clear that we're not just talking about physicians here being involved in the committee. There were other kinds of healthcare workers as well.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I thought the title, The Good Doctors, was such a great title. But in my preface, I say that use the broader definition of healthcare provider. Because one group that I talk about at great length early on were the nurses, young women who came to Mississippi and worked full-time for the medical committee, went out into the communities, went out onto the plantations, and really did most of the work when the medical committee was in the South.
I would expect that these people would have been different on some number of dimensions from the activists, the political activists who had gone there for the Mississippi summer. In what ways were they different?
Well, for one thing, they were older. Most of the volunteers were college students, and the SNCC workers and other civil rights workers were young, along with the older people in the state, blacks in the state who were working with them. They were also trained professionals, doctors and nurses. They had established their careers where most of the civil rights workers didn't have jobs except being full-time movement activists. And it was interesting for me that the original group of physicians who founded the organization were a group of doctors from New York who had very strong histories of being active in left-wing politics.
So it would be fair to characterize these people as political, that in the sense of being engaged in politics, having a strong commitment to a particular kind of political perspective, and then that they were people who not only would advocate that perspective from their armchair, but would be people who would be actually out there and trying to carry it out.
Yeah, that was the thing, that before they came to Mississippi, they had sat around talking a lot about what should be done. They passed resolutions and fired them off to the New York State Medical Society and the AMA. But this gave them the opportunity to put their beliefs into practice on the ground. And they were not only willing, they were enthusiastic. They were excited about getting a chance to become active participants in the civil rights movement.
Apparently, there was some, at least early on, maybe more than just early on, some controversy within the group about what it was, what the best thing for them to do would be, whether the thing to do would be to go and actually stand with the activists, stand with the marchers, really be participants in that way. Or whether, if they were interested in changing the experience of healthcare for black people in the South, whether the thing to do would have been go to engage the white doctors, white Southern doctors, and say, "Look, this isn't what we should be doing as a profession, and that you all should think about changing the system that exists."
Yeah, there were really two factions in MCHR and the split became more obvious after Freedom Summer. During Freedom Summer, everybody pretty much did the same kind of thing, but there was a group headed by one of the primary founders of MCHR, Tom Levin, a dynamic psychiatrist from New York. And for Levin, he made no bones about it, that he felt the job of the doctors was to go lay their bodies on the line for civil rights activists, to become a part of the movement. And he would joke later on that he really didn't care about health care. He just wanted to get out there. There was also another faction, the so-called public health faction, that was more interested in social policy, in ending segregation in medicine, in providing better care for these people who had none at all. And the person that I personified here was a man by the name of H. Jack Geiger, who was one of the leading lights in the medical profession, and as I point out later on, became really the founder, the creator of the Community Health Center movement, which, of course, serves millions of Americans today.
So this, I think, is another really interesting facet to the story and a way in which the story, you know, ripples went out and out and out and perhaps to the present, that he was so inspired and saw that there was this need that he was involved in creating community health centers. There was one in Boston and there was one in Mississippi, and that those things really became models for what then became a much larger movement.
Yeah, In fact, I was just in Mississippi in Mound Bayou last week with Jack Geiger and John Hatch, who was also very much involved. And we visited the center now and talked with local people who had been there back then. And you came away with the feeling of such an impact that these people had made on the lives, and not only with the health care of people. But I think that the community health center movement that they were responsible for back then, you know, has a lot to say to us today about health care, all the questions that we're dealing, the need for primary care physicians. They not only gave out pills and shots, they were interested in the entire atmosphere surrounding this rural, largely black, very poor county. So they went out and to the shacks and they built sanitary privies. They put up screens so the mosquitoes couldn't get in. They were responsible for getting clean water. They were educating people at the same time that they were helping them. And this movement then spread very rapidly. Senator Edward Kennedy, who is the most important person in Washington in health care, saw the potential for the centers, and they spread rapidly throughout the country. And now there are over 1,100 health centers throughout the country with about upwards of 5,000 different sites, and they're providing primary health care for almost 18 million Americans who have no or have been without health care. They are poor, they are from rural areas, and from congested urban areas as well. President Obama is tremendously interested in this in the health center movement, and one of the first things he did was to allocate $2 billion of stimulus money to see that they the health centers were adequately staffed and expanded.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you know, that certainly makes me think about how when you ask, well, what are the things that contribute to people's health or what kind of services do they need? You certainly want to make sure that kids get vaccinated, and you want to make sure that people know have information and they get their blood pressure checked, and if they have diabetes or other chronic conditions, they have education and treatment, and all of that's important. But I think it also makes you think about those things that contribute to public health that aren't shots and aren't checkups and aren't, you know, the things like the conditions under which people live, and do they have, you know, what's the sanitation level, and do they have access to clean water, and, you know, what other kinds of, what environmental pressures do they have to live with that it can affect their health? And it makes you think about how much difference addressing those things made above and beyond things like antibiotics and vaccinations and those sorts of things.
Yeah, it was something that, Geiger and others call these the social determinants of health, that where you live, what your education is, whether you have a good job or not, is really as important as being able to see a doctor, in fact, more important in some places. Because what they found in the early experiments where they didn't have this outreach program, where people would get sick and you would give them shots or whatever, and then they would go back into their unsanitary places and come back with the same problems again. Geiger, one of the things that they found in early Mound Bayou is that people were starving, that they simply because of the collapse of the plantation system, there was no longer any work for them. So what Geiger did right away was to write prescriptions for food. And when one bureaucrat in Washington, you know, called him on that, he said, the last time we looked in the book, the prescribed therapy for malnutrition was food. But they went on from there, and under John Hatch, they developed a farm cooperative, 600 acres of rich delta farmland, where they planted vegetables instead of cotton, and several thousand families were able to survive to plant their own food, and they even were able to export some of it for money.
We are at our midpoint here. We have a caller I'll get right to. I want to take the opportunity to again introduce the guest this morning here on Focus 580. We're talking with John Dittmer. He won the Bancroft Prize and several others for his book, Local People, The Struggle for Civil Rights in Mississippi, that book published by the University of Illinois Press. He's a member of the History Department at DePaul University and is author of a new book that we're talking about here this morning. The title is The Good Doctors, The Medical Committee for Human Rights and the Struggle for Social Justice in Healthcare. It's published by Bloomsbury Press and does indeed tell the story of the Medical Community for Human Rights. This was a group of healthcare workers, doctors, nurses. It was formed in response to the Mississippi Freedom Summer, this effort in 1964 to register black people living in Mississippi to vote. The organizers of the Freedom Summer decided they needed to have some doctors there to take care of their volunteers and their activists. A number of people came there to Mississippi, did get involved not only with the activists but with a lot of local folks there. And among other things, many of these people were some of the earliest advocates for national health here in the United States and continue to be advocates for national health. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455, if folks would like to call and ask questions. We do have someone here where we are, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'll repress the urge to go on about single payer since it may not be entirely germane, but it sounds like they were probably thinking in those terms in the sense that Truman tried to get it through and Roosevelt, and they were closer to that fight that's still the background to what's going on now. And I don't know if you expand on that. And I was actually thinking exactly about what you said about the starvation that was there. I think there might be some people in the audience that think that's overdrawn, but Berry Berry and Kwashiorkor, particularly during the Depression, I guess it continued after that, but nutritional diseases were rampant through a lot parts of the South. I think there's a book called The Politics of Hunger that I stumbled on quite a few years ago that just illustrates that how actually incredibly bad the conditions were. I could go on about contemporary indicators, too, actually, for a while on that note, but because things are bad. I mean, we've got obesity, we've got fast food convenience stores throughout many urban areas. You know, it's sort of a desert of nutritional food, which is not the same as the nutritional disease of that time, but I think it's sort of an inverse parallel, if you will. And I'll hang up and listen because I would like for you to expand on either of those two points, if you would. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in terms of starvation, a group of congressional representatives toured the Delta about this time. Senator Robert Kennedy was among them. Very famous photographs of his in a sharecropper's shack, holding a baby in his arms, where the baby was suffering from malnutrition. A group of six physicians came down and said, "We have." What we have found is not exactly malnutrition. Starvation is the better word. So this was a very real factor then. This was before food stamps were available. And when food stamps did become available, why, initially, people had to pay for them. Well, if you're so poor you didn't have any money, you weren't even eligible for food stamps. In terms of favoring national National Comprehensive Health Care Program, MCHR was there from the beginning. You hear a lot about Truman and Kennedy and Carter and Clinton's efforts to get some sort of comprehensive program. But the one that interested me, that my doctors were involved in, was ironically in the first Nixon administration. There was a widespread effort to get universal health insurance, and everybody had their own plan. The AMA had its own plan, very conservative, you might imagine. Nixon had his, which focused on the health maintenance organizations, the HMOs. But the major plan that had the most support, among liberals at least, was the plan put forth by Senator Edward Kennedy. And that program was the single-payer program. If you look at House Bill 676 today, which calls for a single-payer program, that's practically identical to the bill that Kennedy put forth in 1971-72. It's also interesting that the same arguments that you used to defeat that bill then are out there now, that this would be socialized medicine, that you wouldn't be able to choose your own doctor. Do you want the government making these decisions for you? That was very successful at every stage in the way, and this is what the Obama administration has to deal with today, even though their program doesn't come anywhere near single payer.
At the time, what did people think that it would cost to do this, and how have the costs run up?
Well, I don't have the figures right at hand, but when I noticed that Nixon was so outraged by the increase in Medicare and Medicaid spending, it was just a couple of billion dollars. It was a paltry amount then compared to what it is now, and it would have been, had we solved this problem back then, it would have been, we could have done it much not only more quickly, but at less cost, because what you had since then, of course, is the outrageously escalating cost of not only of drugs, but of charges by hospitals, the insurance companies. The problem is so great now because these costs have escalated so much since the 1970s.
The committee had chapters in various places around the country. One of the places that they had a chapter was Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
and that was the place where they were maybe best positioned to try to influence policy there. And as you said, certainly they weighed in on the discussion on national health, they, I'm sure, advocated for resources for grassroots kind of healthcare activity. Were there some other ways in which, particularly their chapter in D.C., tried to influence policy and maybe perhaps was able to influence policy?
Yeah, the whole idea of the community health centers, for example, that the Washington chapter, along with others, were very influential in talking with congressional committees and getting seeing that resources were allocated fairly when these centers were set up. But they also were active in a very political way, and that is in, and I talk about this at some length, in getting the hospitals in the South to desegregate. That once Medicare was coming onto the scene, why most Southern hospitals were still rigidly segregated. And it took the effort of the medical committee, Dr. Poussaint, and the nurses in Mississippi, along with a lot of others, to get the federal bureaucracy to move into action. And when it did, it moved in very quickly, sending hundreds of federal people into Southern hospitals to investigate conditions and to really engage in a lot of arm twisting. I ran across some incidents that, you know, would be amusing if they were not so bad, and that is that they tried to fool these investigators from north who would come down, and they would suddenly find that there were no black pop patients in the hospital because they'd all been released the day before. Or in one case, a black janitor was put in pajamas and put in a white wing of the hospital. But these subterfuges didn't work, and the hospitals were desegregated. And it was the Washington branch that was working very closely with agencies like health, education, and welfare to make this happen.
You talked about how it is the committee came to be, the fact that it organized in response to a request from activists in Mississippi in 64 who said, well, we've got people down here and they're going to need doctors. So they put out the word, they sent word to New York. They said, look, are there some doctors who'd be willing to come down here for the summer and do this? And there's some that were, and they were very active in Mississippi. Where are some of the other places that committee members were active?
Well, I mean, in Illinois, in Chicago, for example, under the leadership of Quentin Young, who was really Mr. MCHR, that he presided over the organization at its period of its greatest impact, and he was the chair of MCHR during this entire time that they were trying to get a national health program. They had, Young and others had taken an unfortunate utterance by the head of the American Medical Association, who said, "We got to fight this idea that that health care is a right and not a privilege." And so MCHR took out a full-page ad in the New York Times saying that health care is a human right, and they began their lobbying effort there. But in the local city, such as in Chicago, why MCHR people were not only one of the valuable functions that they performed, and we haven't talked about this yet, was medical presence, that wherever there was a demonstration, why the medical committee, the people would be there in their white coats and Red Cross armbands, carrying their bag, assisting people who had been beaten either by a mob or, in some cases, the police. This was certainly the case in Chicago, and the time that the medical committee was most visible was during the Democratic National Convention of 1968, when the police under Mayor Daley inflicted a whole lot of damage on a whole lot of people. And MCHR was not only on the scene, but was also became politically involved later when the Daley administration was saying, well, not many people were hurt and most of these were police. They had the numbers, they had all of the facts, and they presented them. It was also in Chicago that the MCHR worked with the local Black Panther organization to set up a clinic in the inner city. MCHR had been working with the Black Panther leader Fred Hampton, who was assassinated in a police raid, and they were working at that time with Hampton to open this clinic. Well, it opened later, and again, the young doctors, med students, and nurses were very much involved in this.
Did the organization actually take a formal position on the war, on the Vietnam War?
Yeah, they did. It was like it paralleled the civil rights movement in a way, because you'll recall that a number of blacks in the civil rights movement were very reluctant to come out against the war because Lyndon Johnson had done so much for them and because they thought that would dilute their efforts. So when Martin Luther King came out against the war, even his people in his Southern Christian Leadership Conference organization felt that he was making a mistake. The same thing happened with the medical committee. Practically all the doctors and nurses were against the war. But for a time, a number of them said, look, this is we are a civil rights organization. Simply adding the war to our list of causes is not going to be productive at all. But by 1967, why MCHR had taken a strong stand on the war, they lost some members as a result. And from that time on, they were active in a couple of ways. And one way was that they would give draft physicals to young men who were going to be drafted. Now, these physicals were not acceptable. The Army had its own doctors, but they could be—they could call attention to medical problems that the young people had that were not caught by other doctors. They also very publicly tried to send medicine into Vietnam to aid those who had been the victims of say, napalm bombings, for example. took a very public stance on the war. And as a result, for a time, the organization was very unpopular. And it was also a part of its move toward the left in its later years, that the original members, many of whom were active in Mississippi, were falling by the wayside, and the newer members were mostly younger, medical students, nursing students, other healthcare students, and they were very much influenced by SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society, and so the organization took a radical turn to the left in the 1970s.
We have about 10 minutes left. In this hour of Focus 580, our guest is John Dittmer. He's a member of the History Department at DePaul University. He's the author of the book Local People, The Struggle for Civil Rights in Mississippi, and more recently, The Good Doctors, The Medical Committee for Human Rights and the Struggle for Social Justice in Healthcare. It's published by Bloomsbury Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Most of the members of the committee were white, and maybe that's understandable because I'm sure that at this time in the United States, most of the doctors in the country were white. In what way did that end up creating conflict and perhaps being a problem for the committee?
Well, the committee was very self-conscious about the fact that here you are a white civil rights, predominantly white civil rights organization. The first three presidents of MCHR were prominent black physicians. The full-time director of the New York office, a black man by the name of Johnny Parham, came over from the Urban League. And, of course, Poussaint, who headed the Southern Project, was African-American. But the organization was overwhelmingly white, and there were problems there with the National Medical Association, which is the overwhelmingly black counterpart to the AMA. NMA people resented, I think quite justifiably, the fact that here you have this new group of organization that's grabbing all the headlines, thinking that they discovered discrimination in healthcare, when people in the NMA had been working for many years to combat it. The NMA was a pretty conservative organization back then, and one of the things that happened during the 60s was that it became more involved in the civil rights movement. In fact, Mike Holloman, who was chair of the MCHR, moved over to become head of the National Medical Association. So blacks then found that they could, by working in their own organization, could accomplish some of the same things that at MCHR was trying to do. And MCHR never was able to change its identity that much as a predominantly group of white physicians and healthcare people.
All right, let's take a call here from someone in McLean County, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I just got on about 10 minutes ago. But I really appreciate all you're sharing. I would really like to see if you can give two answers. One is there ever a possibility of national health care, and what would it take to do it? Because there are just way too many people who don't have decent health care. I have great health care, but I see things around me that are, to me, devastating. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that takes a crystal ball. The people that I have talked with believe that this time is the most propitious we have had to have some sort of sweeping health care reform. I refer again to Quentin Young, who was a founder of Physicians for a National Health Program, and this is a group of some 16,000 doctors who are favoring single payer. What we have found, and this is why I think many of us are disappointed that the single-payer option has really not been put out there by the Obama administration, that we're hoping to get a public option that people could, like Medicare, that people could sign up for. But every time this happens, why the opposition mounts its all of its resources, and it's going to be tough, but that's why these next couple of weeks are very crucial in Washington, and why people who believe that the system is broke, it's a non-system, need to be lobbying with their own representatives to get something done.
What can the public do? Is there anything that we could do as public? Because somebody on the radio one day at NPR, you know, a reply of a letter talking about why can't we start a movement at a public level so we have enough to, you know, go against the powerful.
Well, there. That's a good question. There are a number of organizations out there. People who are MoveOn.org has rallied some people. There are groups in your state that are lobbying for single payer. There have been demonstrations here in Indiana held in several places. So the options are there. But I think the most important thing is to let your congressional representatives know that there are people at home who want change and want it to be done effectively and now. I sent copies of my book to both of my two congressional representatives in Indiana, both of whom are Blue Dog Democrats, and I figured they wouldn't get a chance to read it all, so I gave them the page numbers that they should check out. Whatever you can do to make your voice heard, why you need to do.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So what became of the Medical Committee for Human Rights?
Well, it just sort of withered away. It fell victim to a lot of the radical politics of the 1970s. By that time, the organization was a very small group. It was attacked from within by various communist organizations, eventually taken over. And then about the time they threw the communists out, why the Reagan administration was here, and there was just no real momentum left for it. So it in a way it went away with not with a bang but a whimper. But as I tried to show, what the legacy of MCHR is in the people who were part of it, and they are all over the place today doing very interesting things.
Yeah, and that's again we get back to people like Sidney Wolf, who went on to found Public Citizen with Ralph Nader, and Quentin Young, who started the Physicians for National Health and has been an advocate for single-payer national health for a long time. And so the people who were involved in this went out and continued to work on some of the same issues, maybe starting other organizations. So you would have to say that the in a sense, the mission of the committee goes on. If the committee doesn't exist, well, the people who were involved in it do, and that they're continuing to work on the same things.
Yeah, I'm just always surprised that whenever I listen to something like the Diane Rehm show and I hear Fitzhugh Mullen, who was one of the leading MCHR people and has become an outstanding, not only writing about health care, but as an activist. I mean, they're really there all across the country.
So you think that there is, in addition to just knowing this story because it's an important chapter in the long history of civil rights and these people and their work should be acknowledged. Is there something you think that we can take away from this, some lessons to be learned that we can apply to the issues that we're still working on? Because there are certainly a lot of things here that we are still working on.
Yeah, I think part of the thing, and this was for me, is just the individuals involved. You know, their stories are inspiring. I mean, one of the reasons I got interested in this group is that they did not fit the stereotype of the conservative physician. They are out there today and have been doing these things all along. So there is much, the whole community health center movement, I think, is something that everybody should know about and should be supporting, that especially with the original vision of it as an all-encompassing center, why this has much to offer to us today. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. Those folks had it right 40 years ago.
You know, certainly there has been a lot written about the civil rights movement, and many scholars, and you and others, have certainly written good books about it. Do you think, though, that there are still pieces here and there, important stories that that are in danger of being lost or have been forgotten and really need to have this kind of attention devoted to them?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously the doctors is one area. The civil rights lawyers is another area that needs to have more attention, people who really devoted their lives to working in the civil rights cause. Yes, and one of the things that I found interesting was that back during the civil rights years, health care was not really on the agenda as much as it should be. Alvin Poussaint once told me he couldn't understand why everybody was out picketing lunch counters. They should have been picketing hospitals instead.
Mm.
So this was an area that I think the movement did not give adequate attention to, and MCHR then helped see people understand that that health care should be a civil rights on the civil rights agenda and high up at that.
Well, we are going to have to leave it at that, with the suggestion that if people would like to read more of this story, they look for the book that we've been talking about. The title is The Good Doctors, The Medical Committee for Human Rights, and the Struggle for Social Justice in Healthcare. And that's the subtitle. Bloomsbury Press is the publisher. Our guest, John Dittmer, is the author. He's a member of the History Department at DePauw University. And Professor Dittmer, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure talking with you.